Good evening, everyone. Are you awake and ready? Let us please pray together. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Blessed Master,
Dearest Mother,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Remain in quiet meditation, focusing upon God alone, invoking the Masters, the Great Master Jesus, Babaji, Lahari Mahasya, Swami Sri Yukteswarji, Master, Mother, our beloved Godfather, Papa, Mataji, Swamiji, truly expanding the heart to saints and sages of all religions, of all climes, of all countries, of this entire world, tuning in to the vibration that they tuned into, feeling the Divine Spirit as they felt the Divine Spirit. What was, is. What is today will be tomorrow. For spirit is eternal. A human life is fleeting, but God is forever. Feel that you are harmonizing yourself with that eternal spirit. Feel the greatness of the peace and of the joy, and of the eternal wonder. Anything less is interference by the mind and by ego consciousness. For you are that, even now. You are that great eternal spirit. Receive it and make it your very own. Very happy to be celebrating this New Year's with you. I was thinking back over it. I think it's been well over 30 years, maybe 35 years, that each New Year's brought in through meditation and being with the group when I've been here. And remembering back to the first time that I joined Mother in a New Year's, thinking 4 hours, and oh gosh, that's a long time to sit and meditate. I think I was a little nervous about it, but it all went so swiftly and beautifully. And Mother would speak through much of the time, and other times we chanted and other times meditated. But never has there been any better way to bring in the new year. I wanted to read to you something that I wrote this part this morning, actually. Dear friends, as we enter 2010, I wish you a bright and wonderful new year.
2009 has been a powerful year of profound spiritual awakening. As devotees, the changes have been enriching not only to you, but the changes you have made have rippled out to your families, onlooking friends, and those you have served. Bringing light to a darkened world is vitally important. As Christian yogis, you represent the highest ideals of both East and West, and bring illumination for yourself and for all creation. For myself, it is the greatest privilege to serve this work and aspirants striving for the highest realization. I'm filled with gratitude to my divine guru, our lineage masters, and my beloved God for giving me this opportunity and responsibility. Because the work I do with those who come for tools and inspiration to change their lives is confidential, I do not tell you of all the successes I see throughout the year. And I know that you have had your own successes as well. However, you may think, I am not sure I have succeeded, as I do not feel the complete freedom I want. And here is an interesting characteristic of growth. You may struggle to gain mastery over some part of your life for a long time. And when you do, two things happen. The first is gaining mastery feels to you as if that is the way it should have been always. And you accept this new way of being instantly, as if it is the way you have always been. Once you gain self-mastery, the world has been set right, and you quickly forget the years, perhaps lifetimes, this problem has plagued you, as if it never was. The second is that the new problems come to block your growth. Suddenly they pop up for you as if they are waiting in queue, anxious to be released. With new and familiar crop of difficulties all clamoring to be dealt with, you feel as if you have not made any progress at all. It is like the farmer harvesting the wheat, facing the acres of land ahead that has yet to be scythed. It is only when he turns around does he see ones that have already been worked. I can tell you that there are many who have cured or in making great progress in curing negative habits, smoking, drug use, unmindfulness in a multitude of areas, unhealthy relationships, adultery, wrong relationships with money, anger, passive-aggressive tendencies, wrong use of sexual energy, depression, alcohol, debt, and bankruptcy, blaming others for one's own problems, and the list could go on and on. I can assure you, even if this sounds like a long list, this is just but a short one compared to the things that I see day in and day out. Along with this letting go of the old, there are also many who have gained new or deeper awareness of an inner joy that is not dependent on circumstances, feeling gratitude for even the smallest of occasions, a new and profound relationship with the world as a whole, deepened relationships with a spouse, children, mother or father, brother or sister, awareness of a tremendous light within, the sound of Om filling the entire being, a feeling of God's presence in thick and in thin, divine love that not only heals one's own hurts, but is a cup that overflows to one and all. In short, I have been witness to the fulfillment of the promise made by the Masters to us all. Spiritual freedom is attainable, and is not something that is relegated to history or fantasy books. As I write these lists, I feel such tremendous sense of gratitude. Gratitude for being given an opportunity by the Masters to participate in the growth of so many. It is as Jesus said, the harvest is great, but the laborers are few. The harvest is great. There is so much more to life than living for the body and ego only. The laborers are few, There are few who are willing to do the work to realize the deeper truths of life has to offer. My friends, God has given us each other as fellow laborers in the field of realization. And this is a rare fellowship. My heart floods with love and gratitude for you. For the gift of our labors together is the greatest gift I can imagine. I have such gratitude for all the support I receive for making me available to do this work. We operate in total simplicity, no organization, no grand churches or lands to maintain. You make of your home a temple in which to worship. We gather together in homes with one purpose in mind, to realize God. Center leaders open their homes for one reason, to join together as kindred souls, sharing in divine communion. There are no secondary reasons for folks to come, no committees to join, no fundraising drives, no board of directors to gain preeminence one over the other. There is no other gain than the greatest victory in all history, God realization. Please join with me in making this new year a time of even greater growth. I would also like you to let your center leaders know how much you appreciate all that they do to make a place for you to come together and experience the synergy of where two or more are gathered. And participate in your center if you have one close enough to attend. There is great strength in coming together. Do not get sidetracked with personality clashes. Rather, think of it as an opportunity for seeing God and one another. And most of all, let us make this a year of loving God more than we love the world. Living in this world demands much from us, so much so that we can lose the importance of our spiritual lives. Let that not be the case with us. Let us know God first, then take what we have freely received and go out to freely give, to give body, mind, and soul in service to the one and to one another. And thank you for all you all for supporting Carla and I with your generous financial contributions and your service to us in countless ways. Have a happy and blissful new year, ever in the light of the gurus. P.S. I am including an additional writing on how to track your progress for this past year and look forward to the new year. Taking stock of the year. During this past year, we have had many challenges on the national and world scale. The economy has taken a hit from poor financial decisions made by both institutions and individuals. Of course, this has had very real consequences for all of us. We also have conflicts and fights in families and families of nations. A sexual revolution that is out of control and making a natural instinct to procreate as a means for hedonism, making money, selling clothes, cars, magazines, almost anything and everything. And we have been witness to greed for more money, food, fame and attention, power and influence, more for more sake. The beginning of a new year is a time to take stock of what you have done and to look forward to a new year. This is a time to analyze how you have conducted the business of your life, money and business. Are you honest in your dealings with others? Are you mindful of how you use money? Are you driven by greed and fear to make poor decisions? To find peace with money and use it mindfully is the key to a balanced and happy existence. Health. It is also time to assess your health habits. You may eat more than you need, creating bodily conditions that sap your strength, make you feel sluggish, and creating dis-ease. Some are not overweight but imbibe too much coffee, pop, sweets, fats, alcohol, cigarettes, or other wrong foods. Use this new year as a time to correct course and get into alignment with those eating habits and exercise that will give you more physical freedom and greater strength. Mind. Mental habits are vitally important to your health and happiness. Do you think positively? Do you avoid gossip and putting others down? Mental habits are so close to home that you may not even be aware of your thought habits. One measurement for mental progress is to examine if your thoughts bring you greater freedom from attachment. Freedom is not just an abstract concept, but is an inner reality. Either you feel freer or you do not. Mental attunement to the divine will give you a feeling of peace, acceptance when appropriate, and courage to change things when that is right. Thought stands as captain of the ship, directing its course, avoiding storms and discovering the best passages. In order to stay true to his bearings, the captain of thought must guide the ship by the pole star of Dharma, right activity. Right thought and activity is initially a product of reason, and then through calmness gained through meditation, an inborn intuitive wisdom awakens. Right thought and activity must be done moment by moment, day by day, without exception, in order to stay true to the course of a fulfilled life. Spiritual. And most importantly, there's the question of your spiritual health. Some points of inquiry will indicate how you are doing. Do you have a larger circle of love for all people and for all creation? Do you feel greater peace, joy, and purity within? Are you more closely drawn to God in meditation and in your daily life? Your spiritual life is the most important factor in having a fulfilling and joyful life. You may not have a lot of money. Your health may not be optimum. And yet, when you feel right with God, you have every right to perfect peace and joy. When your life ends in this body, what you possess and worldly acclaim will mean little. What will stand out to you at that moment of transition is who you are and what you have attuned yourself to. In truth, you are really a manifestation of divine spirit, and what you become is the all-pervading spirit self. With a calm determination, look forward to this new year with the intention that wisdom will be your guide, not the fickle ego mind, nor driven by the senses. Hold yourself accountable and ask yourself the above questions with a certainty that the path is traveled in the simplicity of taking one step at a time. Remember, you are never alone. God and gurus are with you always. Live your life in the joy of knowing that wherever your starting point, when you are sincerely striving to know God, you are doing exactly what you have come to do in this incarnation. And Phyllis Victory, who's in India right now, wrote a piece, and I thought I would read it this evening. Christmas at Ramana Ashram. When the teachers at the Gujarat Ayurvedic University, where I have been attending a 3-month introductory course in Ayurveda, announced that we had 10 whole days off for Christmas, my first thought was to celebrate it at Ramana's ashram and take Swami Vishwananda along. Swamiji had told me that it's hard for him to get around right now due to his failing health. So I emailed him and the ashram to arrange for a stay. Swamiji and the ashram gave their gracious consent. I was allowed to stay from the 25th till the 29th, and Swamiji the same. Swamiji later informed me that he felt uncomfortable staying away so long from his medical support system, so would come for one day and then leave. It was a journey that was not for the faint of heart. I finished a full day of classes and then, along with another student, headed for the overnight train from Jamnagar, Gujarat, to Ahmedabad. Nice on paper, but in reality the beds were really hard and we were both freezing. We had not planned well in the warmth department. Stephanie and I, so it was a sleepless night of cold rocking. Our 11:20 p.m. train arrived in Ahmedabad at 6:30 a.m., and we are then whisked away by a rickshaw, the one for 150 rupees as opposed to the 400 rupee one, to the airport. We each boarded for our separate planes, and I flew off to Bangalore, where Swamiji met me at 11:45 with a taxi. The driver and the person that Swamiji had chosen to look after him, who is also his disciple. We made the four-hour drive in good time. The goal was to reach there in time for the evening puja at 6:30. We just made it. We rushed right into the temple, not stopping at our rooms, our driver maneuvering the hundreds of cars in the parking lot in front of the ashram. We could feel the vibration as we walked up to the temple and were drawn not only by our divine intention, but also by the magnetic quality of Ramana, the chanting and the love and devotion of the thousands who had come here for the same purpose. We are not alone in wanting to celebrate the birth of Christ with Ramana. The hall was resounding with both an inner silence and a deafening devotion. It was a beautiful and uplifting experience. After the puja, we waited in the huge line of devotees for our dinner. Both dining halls were packed overflowing, and we once again were served by the tradition of this great saint, a simple meal of rice and dal. I gave thanks for Ramana and his gift to us all, and his deep but simple teachings of humility, that he lived and remained there for us to all experience to this day. We then retreated to our rooms to unpack, later to meet Swamiji's room for sweets. He comes prepared. The next morning, the stress of all the travel and not sleeping the night before caught up with me, and I slept through the first puja and almost breakfast. It was hours before I forgave myself, but eventually grace descended upon me, and I moved forward. Swamiji took time to meet the president, that is Ramana, and then we piled into the car and proceeded around Arunachala. Swamiji has suggested that we chant the chant for Arunachala without stopping. We chanted the whole time, never stopping, and it was truly uplifting. When we arrived back at the gate of the ashram, I and Swami Vishwananda could barely speak. We all met in my room, and then he ordered his driver to fetch chocolates to celebrate the occasion, which he did. We ate them, and then the three of them left for Bangalore, and I remained at the ashram. For the next 3 days, I am happy to report I did manage to make it up for the early pujas and spent at least 3 glorious days there, meditating in the great hall and the small room where Ramana lived and taught. The question of why am I resonated deeply in my being the whole time I was there and continues. And I kept thinking that the greatest devotion that one could pay to any teacher is to put into action the words that they have shared. The question remains. It's interesting that Phyllis's mind took, why am I? When Ramana's question was, who am I? But it's a provocative question nevertheless, isn't it? Why am I? Why am I? And indeed, both questions lead to the same answer. It's not an answer that we can capture with the mind. It's not an answer that we can reason out for ourselves. Certainly we can use the reasoning mind. We can try to figure out those answers, but there are some answers that must come from a deeper source. We are born with the mind, but the mind is limited. In the beginning, we have all come with complete and total divine consciousness, and through our connection with divine consciousness, we have available to us all intelligence, all the answers, everything that is required by the divine that is within us. However, we have gone on a long journey, and in that journey we have separated ourselves from the divine consciousness. And so we use the reasoning mind to the best of our ability to try to get along in this life. And indeed, we find that it can be very efficacious for many things that we are attempting to do. But we are always longing for that reunion with the divine consciousness. And nothing will really replace that. No pleasure in this world, no accomplishment, nothing that we can gain. It is tremendously interesting to take a look at those who have climbed to the pinnacle, you might say, of worldly attainment, and how many of them attain complete and total happiness. And I think you would find that if there are any who match that, it's a very short list. It seems that the more the worldly attainment, the more the problems that come along. And it's a very interesting thing, because those who gain fame want seclusion oftentimes. Those who gain great wealth oftentimes want to live in ways that are very simple. To those who are attuned within, they have and they know that their happiness does not come from money, from fame, from power, from any of those kinds of sources at all. They can't come from that. It can only come from within. But sometimes we have to experience enough in this world to really know that. Like the comedian who said, "You know, I always hear that money can't buy happiness." He says, "I just like to have enough money to really know that that's true." And isn't it true? Somewhere in the back of our minds, we always think, if I just had enough money, I would really be happy. I wouldn't have these worries. I wouldn't have to worry about the rent. I wouldn't have to worry about food. I wouldn't have to worry about larger concerns that plague me constantly. I could really let go of this. But, you know, the truth is that if money is not our direct concern, then all other kinds of things come up. And I think one of the biggest ones is that when we get enough, we realize that it's not enough. And either we start striving for more because we think that will be the answer, or the other kinds of difficulties around relationships, around self-image, around the things that still continue with us, that wherever we go, there we are. And there's no magic cure. And it's interesting to me that people think they can live in any particular way that they want to in this lifetime, but somehow, when they go up to heaven, everything's going to be improved. Everything's going to be changed. But I wonder if they really started thinking about it, if they saw one of their arch nemesis when they were up in heaven, what would they think? Oh, why is she up here? I thought she was supposed to be down in the hot spot. She didn't talk very nicely about me. She didn't treat me very well. And what about him over there? He's a big, greedy, kind of fat cat kind of guy. What's his problem? Why is he up here? It's an interesting thing that Yudhishthira is the eldest of the Pandus. And the five Pandu brothers represent the five chakras. And Yudhishthira is the fifth chakra. He's very high up. And he knows Dharma. He knows what is right action. When he arrives up in heaven, who does he see there? He sees his evil cousin, Duryodhana. Now, Duryodhana was responsible for the massacre of millions of lives. He was, in those days, what Hitler represents today. And he's disgusted when he sees him. And Vyasa says, walk over to your cousin and give him a kiss on the cheek. Well, he's just disgusted by the idea. What? He's here? I can't believe it. And where are my brothers? They're all good men. And where is my wife? A good woman. They're down in hell. He's shocked. He's astounded. They're in hell. Everything is upside down. His sense of righteousness, his sense of what is good, what is true, all gets turned topsy-turvy. And so he rebels at this idea. He says, I'd rather be with my brothers in hell than up here in heaven with this evil monster. And so, sure enough, he goes down to hell. And there they smell rotting flesh. It's their form of sulfur, I guess, is having rotting flesh down there. It's disgusting. The air is stale. It's dark. He can't see anybody. He calls out, and his brothers and his wife all call back to him and say, oh, it just feels so good. You just brought a little bit of fresh air with you. And we feel so much better with you here. Now, what is the meaning of this story? And it's an interesting meaning. Not anybody is all good or all bad. And going up into heaven after the point of death, those who are mostly bad get to experience whatever good karma they had, so they get to ascend up to heaven. Those who are mostly good pay whatever debt they have. When they have paid their debt, then they go up to heaven. And for the evil, when they have garnered whatever little good that they have done, then they go down to the hellish plane of consciousness. And isn't that interesting? Because sometimes in this world, we see people who are very definitely doing the wrong things, and they seem to excel. And here we are, we're trying to do the right thing, and we're struggling. We're struggling for money. We're struggling for any kind of good things to happen to us. And sometimes it seems like it doesn't come, or sure doesn't come as easy as it comes to some others. And we start to question ourselves. Here I am. I'm trying to lead a good life. And everything seems to go against me. And that other yahoo over there, he's doing everything wrong and everything's coming to him. What in the world's going on here? It turns our world upside down. And when we understand that those who do things that serve the ego only can excel for a time, they can get their desserts. They can get their good that comes to them, but it comes at a price. Because later on, they have to pay the price for everything that they've done against truth, against God. And for the individual who has striven to live their life the best they know how, and perhaps in their own minds, they have not met with great success, but they have done their very level best. They just seem to meet one obstacle after another. But they have paid off their debt. And having paid off their debt, they are then enabled to live in heavenly consciousness. So when seen from that viewpoint, you begin to understand that it's not always how things appear. That sometimes when you try to do the right thing, things can come towards you that are very difficult to take. This is not because God is punishing you. There's just a simple law. It's just as much a law as anything that we see in this world and this universe. There is the law of gravity. And if you step off the top of a 10-story building, gravity is going to take over. Now, you wouldn't say that gravity is punishing you. You would just say that's the law of gravity, and that's what's going to happen when you step off that building. And in the same way, when we go against God's law and spiritual law, We pay the price. Gravity takes over. Gravity in that field of consciousness, in the spiritual field. And it operates just as surely, just as mathematically true, as anything that we see in the physical sciences. And so we begin to understand that. We set our ship on the right course. We continue to steer it to the best of our ability. We call upon God and Gurus. We strive for everything with everything in our heart and our mind and our soul in order to do things the right way. And we understand that there may be times when we have to suffer and that things don't come as easy. And we can look at the other person and we can say, boy, they just seem to have an easier time of it. I've told you before, but one of the great privileges that I get is to talk with people privately, confidentially, and about the things that bother them about themselves and about their lives. And I will hear one person say, oh, my life is so miserable, but geez, I look over at this other devotee and they seem to have it made. Everything seems they don't have any money worries. Everything seems to come easy to them. They're gregarious. They're outgoing. And gosh, they just don't seem to have any problems at all. And I just feel filled with problems. Then I talk to the other person they've been talking about. Oh, their life is bad. They feel bad about themselves. They don't know what they're going to do. They're in debt up to their eyeballs. And gosh, they have to work so hard and it's so stressful. And you begin to figure it out. We all live these lives of quiet desperation. And we don't know that we are a part of humanity, and humanity, by and large, lives that kind of life of quiet desperation. And isn't it a sad thing, even for devotees, even for those who are striving to know more? But as I said in this writing, there are ways that we can measure, and we have to hold ourselves accountable. Just because we're on the right team doesn't guarantee that we're going to win. We have to be more than on the right team. We're given the greatest tools known to mankind. We're given chanting, divine sacred chants. We're given Kriya Yoga. We're given Hong Sa meditation. We're given all the tools that are necessary to lead a tremendously successful spiritual life. But just like the disciple of Lari Mahasya, who is complaining to the master, he says, I want further initiations because I don't feel like I'm making the progress. I think I'm ready for this other because I'm not getting what I want here. And in wandered the mailman. Now, in Lari Mahasya's sphere of life, the mailman happens to be a devotee of his. And he comes in, and he's a small, unassuming man. He's carrying his packages. He comes in, and he sees this as an opportunity to get darshan of the master. After he pronams, he asks the mailman, he says, do you want more initiations? And the mailman pronounced to him and said, oh, master, no. He says, I've come here to ask your blessings. He says, I am in such bliss with what you've already given me, I can't even hardly deliver my mail. And the other man who had been complaining said, oh, I can see. I'm a poor workman blaming my tools. We are given these tools. They are simple. But they are profoundly powerful. Do we use them? Do we put them to use? Do we put them up on the shelf where they look kind of pretty, but they don't do any good? And that's not beautiful at all. You know, the best books are the ones that are dog-eared, that are yellow with age, that have been used. Maybe they have underlines under words. Maybe they have writing off in the margins. Maybe they have yellow marks on them. They've been loved. They've been used.
The things that were given do no good if they are not used. There's a beautiful story. It's a beautiful story, I guarantee you. It's about a man who's a butcher. Now, of course, he lives in India, and butchers aren't seen as very spiritual. That's not, if you got anything going for you spiritually, that's not where you're supposed to be. But he had this little weight that he used for weighing out the meat before he sent it out. And he was a great devotee of Shiva. And all day long, he would chant to Shiva. He would think of Shiva. He was always caressing this little piece of weight that he used, chanting Shiva's name, loving Shiva, thinking of Shiva. And one day, a Brahmin was walking by, and he wouldn't even hardly look at a butcher. But he just happened to see this weight. And he noticed that this weight was nothing other than a Shiva Linga. Now, this is considered a very sacred thing, something you would put in the temple and that you would worship with great devotion. And here it was being used by a butcher to weigh meat. Oh, he was aghast. He went up and he scolded the butcher vigorously and said, "Give me that weight. I will wash off all the pollution and I'll do all the chants and everything that's necessary. And I will take proper care of this." And so the butcher, not meaning to do anything wrong or any harm, quickly gave up the linga. And off it went with this Brahmin. Now the Brahmin took it home and he did everything technically right. But he had no love in his heart. He had no real devotion for God. And so after being there for some months, the man had a dream, the Brahmin had a dream. And in the dream, Shiva came to him. And Shiva said, "Oh, being at your house is dry as dust. I love being fondled by that man who owned the butcher shop. Will you not take me back?" He says, "I am so lonely here. I get no love, I get no attention, I get no devotion. True, you fulfill the law, but it leaves me with like dust in my mouth. Please take me back." Well, the Brahmin was tremendously humbled by this, but he was obedient to Shiva, and he took the Shiva Linga back to the butcher. And the butcher was so thrilled because he just felt a special relationship with this weight that he used every single day, thinking of Shiva, chanting his name. You see, it was the sweetness in his heart that made the difference. So it is not just practicing the things that we've been given, but to practice it with love, with devotion. Now, some people say, "I have little love, little devotion. I'm mostly kind of a reasoning type of a person. I don't feel that kind of love for God." But you know, that is a gift that comes from God. I remember when I felt no love in my life. I felt no love for any person. I didn't feel love for God. I heard Mother talk about love of God. I thought that was interesting, but I had no idea what it meant. And I finally decided I have to know what it is that she's talking about. See, sometimes people hear things from the guru, and they find fault with the guru if it doesn't match their own experience. But a real devotee will think, "Well, I don't know what that means." You don't pretend to something that you don't know. But you can start to search out for it. You take it as a prompting. You take it as a challenge, and I took it as a challenge. And so I started reading about two great saints, one of the East and one of the West. The one of the East was Ramakrishna. And Ramakrishna was a great lover of God. He just felt such tremendous desire and love for God. And he practiced intense sadhana. He was married. He lived at a temple as a priest. But really, because he was a priest, he wasn't really very qualified for being a priest. I'll tell you why. When he was worshiping the Divine Mother, he would become in such an uplifted, intoxicated state of love of God that he would start putting the flowers that he's supposed to be putting onto the Kali statue, he'd put it over his own head. He's supposed to put sandal paste on the Kali statue, but instead of doing that, he would put it on himself. And then he would lie down in front of Mother Kali in a super conscious state. Well, the other priests would see this. This is entirely improper. And what priests specialize in is doing everything very properly. And if something is done out of order, if something is done improperly, the whole place has to go through a ritual cleansing. They were disgusted by this man. And they would come up to him when he was in samadhi, laying down on the floor with his feet pointed towards Mother Kali. And they would kick him and hit him and, "Get up, you scoundrel. What's wrong with you? You're a crazy man." And there's many who thought him to be crazy. But the individual who was the manager of this temple was the nephew of the Rani. That's a rich lady, and she had the place constructed, and he managed it. And one day, when he saw Ramakrishna pacing along on some of the steps, he looked at Ramakrishna, and he thought maybe he was hallucinating, because he saw God pacing back and forth, not the human being, Ramakrishna. And he rubbed his eyes, and he looked again, and he saw the same. And he became convinced this was no ordinary priest, but this is a tremendous God-man. And so it disqualified him from becoming a priest. But he became a great, great saint. And then there was Saint Francis. And Saint Francis was just a young man, full of oats, going out. You know, many of the saints, they start out with kind of a raucous life. And that was Saint Francis. He liked to party. He liked the ladies. He liked the high life, and he had a wealthy father, so he was able to do all of this. But after he went off to a war, he had a very troubling time of it. He was in prison for some time until his father paid a ransom, and it was all arranged, and he came home. And then he was very, very ill. And through these circumstances, he had an inner awakening happen somehow. And then he left that life. And he went out and he completely threw his lot in with God. And he loved God. He loved God with all of his heart, mind, and soul. I remember talking to a devotee of Masters. And he's saying, Saint Francis is like that, like this. And it was an evening time, just like this is right here. He said, if he heard about Master living down in Los Angeles, he'd get up, he'd walk out the door, and he'd start walking for Los Angeles. That's St. Francis. He wouldn't waste a minute. He wouldn't worry about money. He wouldn't worry about clothes, nothing. He'd be on the road, walking, getting there as fast as he could. Isn't that wonderful? How many of us run for God? How many of us put all of our energies, all of our thought, all of the power of our being into finding God? Think of Papa, think of Master, think of Mother. What tremendous will they had to find the divine consciousness. They weren't of divided mind. They knew what they wanted. They were absolutely clear that God alone could fulfill their desire, could fulfill what they wanted in their heart and their soul. Now, we live lives in this world. So we have jobs, we have things that we have to do. We live a divided life to some degree, because in the beginning we don't realize that God is everything. But we can strive to make God everything. We can strive to find God in absolutely everything that we do. We can find God in our family. We can find God in our job. We can find God in breathing. We can find God in moving and acting and serving and every God-blessed thing that we do. Now, we all have those moments when we can have some enjoyment, when there can be some recreation. But God is there as well, is He not? Is there any place, is there anything that you can do that God is not a part of it? Because without God, you could not have the life energy by which you move this body, by which you speak, by which you think. There's not anything that you do that is not directly connected to divine consciousness. The reason you don't know that is because you have not yet paid the price to realize that supreme knowledge. So we must be willing to pay the price, but we must be willing. We must develop that kind of will that this devotee had said about St. Francis, that if he heard about Master that night, he'd be on the road. He'd be out the road, out the door, and on the road. We have to have that kind of intensity. We have to have that kind of passion. But when we don't have it, and we find ourselves to be lukewarm, you know, Jesus said, I'd rather have somebody hot or cold. Lukewarm is impossible. What do I do with that? If somebody's cold, at least that's life energy. If they're repulsed by God, at least that's life energy. If somebody's absolutely neutral, what can you do with that? There's nothing. So we pray to God for love of God, for passion for God. You see, love is what we are attracted to. Love is what our mind automatically goes to. If you love a person, if you fall in love, that initial falling in love, your feet are a little bit walking on air, you can't help but think about the person you're in love with. Your mind is constantly turning to them. Ramakrishna once made the analogy that it's like the woman who's married, but she has a lover outside the marriage. A little bit scandalous kind of imagery, but saints oftentimes use this to try to shock us and wake us up. She can't help, as she goes about her duties, thinking about her lover. Oh, when will she see him next? Oh, what will it be like? Oh, what was it like last time? Can you imagine being like that with God? You can't think. You don't want to think about anything else. You want that love. You want that devotion. You want the object of your desire. But too many of us are lukewarm. We don't strive. We don't give ourselves. And why don't we? It's the ego nature that holds itself back. Will I be disappointed? Who will I be? How will I be? Will others think me strange? Deranged? Mother Krishna Bai had that. She was striving for God with everything in her soul. Papa said, go out and serve others in the village. So she would just show up at somebody's home. What do you need? Some ironing, some washing, some cleaning of your house? And she would do it. And others would wag their tongues about her. Oh, here's this young lady. She's going out to this ashram. She's spending all of her time with this guru. Is this the right thing? She didn't care. Or if she did care, she didn't let it stop her. Because she knew what she wanted and she knew what Papa had to give to her. When Mother first came to Papa at the ashram, Papa came and met with her. And then Papa just kind of got up a little bit to adjust his clothes, to adjust himself. He wasn't going anywhere. And Mother, with a start, said, oh, Papa, are you leaving? And Ramdas said, no, no, I'm just adjusting myself a little here. She is so anxious to get every drop of God. She said that she had felt bad because when she would meet with Master, what was in her mind was all of the concerns, family, children, husband, those things that filled her up, and that she didn't really feel like she got the full spiritual benefit that she had wished that she had. And so when she went to Papa, she recognized the same God within him that she had worshipped so fervently in her own guru.
And so she didn't want to waste a single drop, not a single drop. You see, what is transmitted from the guru, some of it can come through words, some of it through a glance. But there is a spiritual emanation that goes out from the guru, because God has ordained that that one bring other souls back into his heavenly kingdom. And it is a wonderful and divine relationship. And it is something that we should treasure with all of our heart, mind, and soul. And death does not make us separated. There was a time after Mother's leaving that it was difficult for me to feel her presence. And it felt to me as if perhaps she was gone in a way, that maybe she was completely indrawn into the impersonal Spirit of God, getting the much-deserved rest that she should have had. Or perhaps her attention was elsewhere. And when we presented that to Swamiji, Swami Satchidananda, he said, "No, she has not gone anywhere. It is you who are blinded to her presence. She was always there." You see, so we need to challenge ourselves. So this coming year, I want you to take this challenge. You know, Pepsi has a challenge. God has a challenge. Can you taste God? Can you appreciate the wine of the presence of God? Can you let that love in you for God grow more than your love for this world? The world draws us very powerfully, but God is more powerful and more intoxicating once we get a taste of Him. Really, a good long drink. And then we taste the world and we taste God and we compare. And there is no comparison. And we begin to love God. Why? Because we love what we receive when we attune ourselves to God. We love the peace. You see, you take a person with a restless nature and you try to put them into a peaceful kind of environment. They won't like it. Where's the action? Where's the activity? All of this quietness, all of this stillness that drives me crazy. It's an interesting thing that at one time when rap music and hip-hop was so popular and the kids would hang out at the 7-Eleven stores and they were such a crowd around there that they'd actually drive customers away. And so some of the stores began to play classical music. Well, this was like fingernails on the chalkboard to these young kids. They had to get out of there. They didn't like it. And so they would actually leave the place as a way for them to kind of clear things out so the customers wouldn't be scared to come into the store. Isn't that an interesting thing? What is absolutely wonderful to one person is just the opposite to another person. And so you take a worldly person and you try to give them God experience, and they don't like it. When Ramakrishna gave, who eventually became Swami Vivekananda, a God experience, he felt the energy began to move inside of him. And he says, "What are you doing to me? What are you doing to me? Make this stop." He wasn't ready for it. And so Ramakrishna slapped him lightly over the heart and made it all stop for him. Now later on, he would have given anything in the world to have that touch because he wanted it so badly. But in that moment, he was not prepared. And so we must prepare ourselves the best that we can. Make ourselves fit receptacles for the divine consciousness. And then we will know that God has always been dwelling within us. He is the thought behind our own thoughts. He is the feeling behind our own feelings. He is the life behind our own activity. That in truth, we have never been separated from God, nor can we ever be.
So let us dedicate ourselves with renewed zeal and find that divine consciousness that we have been yearning for through all the other desires we have had. They all lead, all roads lead to Rome, huh? And all paths of life ultimately lead to God. Because it's the only goal that will completely and totally satisfy the soul. Let's close this hour with some continuous melodious ohms. Ooh.